during the period when we were facing the Germans and they were facing us, in the month before we actually took Lubizi, we were largely based on a village called BV. The front line was actually through the bottom end of the village, and of course it wasn't a sort of solid front line in the First World War sense. It was a series of strong points, and Germans would come up in the night and come quite close, and actually into parts of the village, and you couldn't help that happening. And I suppose it was the same with us, really. We used to go out in the valley that separated us from Lubizi Hill, and some of our patrols actually got into the edge of Lubizi themselves. But it was a strange situation. When it was quiet, it was deathly quiet, because there were no birds or anything. The trees were all bare, and a bit like First World War scenes that you see on films. But then occasionally, either side would open out and open up all the guns for about 5 minutes. We used to call it a 5-minute hate. Another strange thing was that the civilians were still there in the village, because we were still so close to the coast that there was nowhere to where they could be evacuated. And I always remember the mayor one day gave me a box of Camembert cheese, which was a great treasure. And the only trouble was he'd had it so long that it apparently smelled to high heaven. And although I've got no sense of smell, the other lads in the section had. And we were living in a big hole with shelves cut out for desks, or whatever you would call them. It was our office, and our where we lived, and we had to shave out of our mess tins and all that sort of thing. And they wouldn't have this cheese in the hole with us, and I had to keep it under a hedge and nip out when I wanted to get at it. I said the front line went through the bottom end of the village. One day when I'd been to see A Company, who were just down at that end, I was coming away, and I was surprised to find a convoy of trucks, about 5 or 6 big trucks coming down the road. Fortunately for them, there was a log across the road to stop anybody going through, otherwise they would have been in no man's land. And they were wanting to get to, I can't remember where, but they were hopelessly lost. And so I turned them round, because once you got to where that log was, the Germans could see you, and they could do something about it if they so wished. So I turned them round as quickly as I could, and these lorries were full of soldiers in the back. And I jumped in with the driver of the first one and took them back up to the back end of the village. And as we went up the road, we could hear the shells dropping behind, so they'd obviously been spotted. Anyway, they were away, we got rid of them. In the village, there was one man in particular. He was a student from Caen University, named Philippe. And he used to come and talk to me a lot. He used to bring me a lot of information. And he also made sure that the civilians still there were treated properly. One day he asked me if I could help an old man who was sick. And he took me to a farm where there was a big barn, and a sort of semi-underground section to it, and the women and children of the village and the old people were all living down in this semi-underground place. And I took the motorbike. We had a motorbike which belonged to the intelligence section, and we put the old chap on the pillion, and every time I tried to pull away he started to whimper and shout, and all these people round about kept saying, "Gently, gently, doucement, doucement." I managed to get him back down to the coast, and he gets some medical treatment there, although I don't quite know what happened to him after that. I couldn't stay. There was another occasion, this wasn't at Beeville, but it wasn't far away, but it was at a later stage, where an old man, an old farmer, had some shrapnel in his foot, and his son asked our doctor if he could remove it, and the doctor didn't speak any French, so he asked me to be there to talk to the old man. And so I sat holding his hands as he lay there, and the dog got to work at the other end, and the old man kept shouting, "Assez, enough, enough." So I remember saying to the dog, "You said he's had enough, doc." And the dog said, "Oh yes, no, I'm quite finished yet. You're very down to earth, our doctor, but very good." But that was a little later. But we had a number of things happened. Philip had a young sister named Soulange. She'd be about 12 or 13. And she said that she'd seen German soldiers dressed in British uniform. So we had to look into this, and we went to a lot of trouble. We actually called in field security from down at the coast. But it turned out that they were English soldiers, and when she'd gone bothering them, they'd said, "Allez tout suite." And she said, "Well, that was what the German soldiers used to say." So it was all about nothing. And I felt a bit embarrassed to have fetched in the field security for it. Philippe and Marcel and Soulange, they lived in normal circumstances at a very big house. Well, it was a small chateau on the edge of the village, and it was in a part where the German patrols would come up at night. And there was a bathroom there. Of course, we had no baths, no anything. The only trouble was the bath had a shrapnel hole in it, so it would only hold a certain amount of water when you had water. So I remember one day begging a jerry can of water, or water in a jerry can, from the cook, who used to operate again in a sort of semi-dugout garage place, and strapping it on the back of the motorbike and dashing off down to the chateau, and then pouring this water into the bath and having a quick bath. Another thing they had down at the house was a grand piano, and Jimmy Baldwin, our corporal, was one of those people who could play anything by ear or music. And one day he and Marcel and Philippe and Soulange and I were down there, and Jimmy gave us a little recital, and I always remember Marcel asked him if he could play a tune called "Shoo Shoo Baby," which was partly an American tune that I'd never heard of. But it struck me as strange that there they'd been cut off under the Nazis, and he must have been listening to some American program or something to want a song like that.
He was a good pianist, was he?
Oh, Jimmy was, yeah. yes. Play piano or string bass or, yeah, very talented. He only died 2 or 3 years ago, and I have a tape from his brother of their dance band.
Really?
Playing New Year's Eve at Smethwick Baths, yeah. It's a nice souvenir to have,
because it's in Dutch.
Listen to that near Jimmy on it.
Yes.
Yeah.
How long was you in this area before you pushed?
Well, it was about a month. It was it was from D plus one up to when we eventually took the Beezy village, which
you actually saw the bombing of Caen, didn't you?
Oh yes, it did. Very spectacular, but I don't know how much help it was. I don't think it was a good idea myself, but I think we would have been as well without it, to be honest.
You went
to the civilians, of course, would have been much better off without it.
Yes. Did you actually go through Caen from there, or did you go around it?
The next thing we did was an attack down to the southeast. They tried to, well, I don't know if it was really an intention actually to break out, but to push the Germans across the River Orne, the east side of the River Orne, and down in the Paris direction. And we were at a place called Emmyville, near to Troyes, and we had to take a chateau there, and it was a night attack. He didn't get very many night attacks. It was a rough old place, but the attack, the first attack, was successful. And I always remember that evening hearing a German lad shouting, well, he was moaning, and he kept saying, "Tommy, Tommy, Tommy." And I, of course, I couldn't do anything about it, but I just called to him that somebody's coming, "Man kommt," that was all I could think of to say, "somebody's coming." And when I had a chance, I told our stretcher bearers about him, and they went and had a look later, but he was dead. But once we'd taken that place, at Emmyville, naturally the Germans set themselves to get it back, or at least to make it hot for us. And they shelled and shelled and shelled. And my boss, who took over from Peter Lamb, a chap named Smith, he was killed by shelling there. And I remember going into the woods. There were some woods not far from the chateau itself, and our A company was there. And we had a report that there'd been a lot of German tanks knocked out there. And I went, as part of my duty, to have a look at them and report on them. And sure enough, I forget how many, but there were lots of these things, including a Panther tank that had lost its gun. It had been knocked off. And it was a godforsaken place. And A Company headquarters was in the ruins of the church, and it wasn't very nice. And they had a chap brought in there who'd really lost it. He was hysterical, really, and in a
German?
No, a soldier, an English soldier. Yeah, he was really it was a poor thing. And, of course, they didn't know what to do with him, really, there. And I said, well, I've got to get back to the chateau anyway. So I'll take him. And I took this poor chap through the woods and handed him to our medical people. And just after we'd left, they were all blown up at the day company headquarters. So that poor chap did me a good turn. He made me choose the moment to move, you see.
Yes, yes.
And then it was after that that old Smith, my own boss, was killed. It was another sort of semi-underground place, and these shells kept crumping against the wall. And I don't know just what happened, because we just found him dead there. Robin Cryer, the second in command, said, "Get your chaps to move some of these bodies, it's upsetting people." And the first one we turned over was our own boss. And then the doctor was killed. Well, he was wounded, and I always remember him saying to his sergeant, "Let tell my wife I had a knock." And we heard he died in hospital. This isn't the one who took the shrapnel out. He was the one, that was the one that followed this one.
You took a lot of casualties, didn't you?
Well, yeah. We were an infantry battalion, weren't we? That was inevitable for an infantry outfit.
Very up the
people,
the sharp end.
If you have a tank, it's somebody on one side or the other's got to go, haven't they? But yes, it was a lousy old place. And our motorbike. We had an AGS at that time. I don't know why. It's the only time we've ever had one. And it was nobody was on it. It was leaning against the wall. But the petrol tank was all punctured. And so when we were withdrawn, we were relieved. Of course, it was left there, and nothing I could do about it. And I always remember the motor MT sergeant. He said, "Well, it's the intelligence to come fetch it." And we didn't want to go and fetch it. And the company commander, I remember, he said, "No, it's for the MT to fetch it back." He said, "We can't risk sending us our intelligence sergeant."
You were worth your weight in gold.
I wasn't ready. No, it was just fortunate that you saw it that way.
Yes.
Yeah, and it was after that we were pulled out for a week, and that was when the doctor who followed the one who was killed took out the shrapnel from the old farmer. And before, after only a few days, we were then moved right away to the other end of the front, next to the Americans, further west, to the Bocage. And we were... We left, I think it was First Corps we were in to begin with, and we were put into a strategic reserve, and we were loaned out to the 11th Armoured Division. Remember they had the buffalo, that's their logo.
Yeah.
The buffalo.
Yes.
11th Armoured, they were a very good division. They used to say they did the work, the Guards Armoured Division had the publicity, and the 11th Armoured Division did the work.
Really?
Yeah.
I heard that.
And we moved up. There was a place called Prell. We moved in there, and the enemy had gone. It had been taken once, it had been wounded and the other a bit. And then we went forward to a place called Le Bas Perrier, which it's beautiful rural countryside. We've been back and picnicked there since, but quite hilly, woody, and you wound down a hill to this place and then up to this position. We didn't take it, it had already been taken, but then we moved in and took over from the people that had taken it. And in the hollow, as it went towards it, came round a corner, and there was a German tank with its gun pointing. Unfortunately, it had been knocked out, it was empty, but Just as you came round this corner, there you saw this...
You didn't know that at the time?
Well, no, I suppose it was obvious, but... and then, when you got up to the position and we started to dig in, there was so little depth of earth before you got to the rock. We could only dig shallow trenches. And for one of our companies, the tanks from 11th Armoured, they said, don't worry, we'll make a roof for you. And they straddled the slip trenches.
Really?
On the roof for a while. Yeah. And then, unfortunately, after a few days, they were withdrawn, so we all felt a bit naked. And while we were up there, of course, we were forward of any of the other troops, forward of the main line there. So, naturally, the Germans wanted to wink us off. And we were even bombed on one occasion by our own rocket things.
Tommy Firth?
Fortunately, they missed. But we had to send up, I think it was yellow smoke, I forget what sort of smoke, to let them know it was us and not the Germans. And while we were there, I lost my next boss, intelligence officer, a chap named Groom, a very, very nice lad he was. I stood between him in a slip trench and led him to Norton, one of our section. And they were both wounded with airburst shells. And I was all right. Another thing I remember there, at night after dark, the water truck used to come up, and supply trucks and things like that. And the water truck was driven by a series of different drivers so that there'd be a fair turn of the less pleasant jobs, you see. And we kept our own truck back at what was called, we called the Echelon, a few miles back, because it was really a soft vehicle. It wasn't a fighting vehicle or anything like that. And we didn't. It was in the way if we got it up with us, really. But one night, when the water truck came up, old Frank Allen, our driver, was driving it. And I always remember he pulled up and parked exactly where all day there'd been intermittent machine gun fire coming in. I said to him, Frank, I should just pull about so and so up in that direction. Then I told him afterwards. Funny how you remember little things.
Yes,
I also remember having a tin of treacle pudding there. They used to have tin puddings and they'd warm them up in hot water, you know. And you could sometimes beg one and eat it cold, an extra one. They were lovely, these treacle puddings were. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, but that's one of the little things sticks in my mind there. But, and then...
Were the rations brought up, or was your own cook in that position?
No, they were cooked further back. They were just brought up and dished out, It was only in the early days when we carried, when we landed, we had 2 48-hour packs with, this mince stuff that you dehydrated stuff, you spread it, put water in your mess tin and sprinkled it on the top of the water and warmed it on a little tummy. We had some little blocks of it would be spirit, wouldn't it?
Molotics,
and the little crisscross of tin that just dug into it, pushed into it, and then you lit it and you warmed whatever you got with your mess tin. And this mince became some tasteless meat stuff, you see. But you had a nice little couple of pieces of cheese and things like that, you know. Yes, that was the first few days, and of course you'd no bread. I can't remember when we started to have bread. It was all biscuits for the first month or so, I suppose.
Well,
then we began to have these rations and with a cook, and they'd be brought up, as I say, at this place. They were brought up during the night, you see. If it were quieter, they'd come up during the day. And then we were due to be relieved by the Herefords, and their advance party came, and while they were there, some airburst shelling started, or shelling, I don't know which, we shot into our funk holes, and we squatted there, and really to ease tension, I said to this lad from the Herefords, it isn't a very big county, not many people live there. Are there any people from Hereford, you see? He said, well, not many. He said, as a matter of fact, I'm from Staffordshire. I said, oh, so am I. Where are you from? Well, he said, a place called Leek. And he was born...